This week, the Dow Jones Industrials and S&P 500 closed at yet new all-time record weekly highs, while gold and silver found support on news of an ECB rate cut. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you with what could be the most important broadcast of 2014. Happy days are here again, at least according to Wall Street. Investors cannot get enough of U.S. stocks. The Dow Jones Industrials and S&P 500 blasted to the highest points in history on better-than-expected domestic economic reports. ECB easing and economic growth are inflationary, right? You bet, says James Turk from GoldMoney.com, co-author of the bestseller The Money Bubble, returns to the show with a gold market update. The ECB surprised investors this week, dropping their benchmark overnight lending rate into negative territory down to negative 0.1%. James Turk notes that the EU is sending a stark message that purchasing power of the euro currency will be devalued, and this could be presenting an ideal opportunity for bargain precious metals. You know, central banks are panicking around the globe. Their theories aren't coming to pass. They may have forgotten that the government is there not to create wealth. Its sole purpose is to facilitate economic growth and general welfare. Excessive taxation erodes living standards at just the wrong time, when businesses and families and individuals need help the most. China and Russia have signed an energy deal using yuan and rubles, and this is further jeopardizing the dollar status in the petrodollar arrangement. Nevertheless, the time might not be too far away when no fiat currency will be accepted as payment for energy imports, and that's music to the ears of precious metals investors. Then, working with the head of Nenner Research, David Gurwitz uses advanced mathematical models and algorithms to identify profitable patterns in the market. Their models correctly predicted the gold peak in 2011, and now, guess what? They see a bottom in the gold market. Stocks and bonds may be the investment du jour right now, but soon both will enter multi-decade downturns, along with the U.S. dollar, according to their models. In addition, gold stocks will re-enter a healthy bullish cycle after the underlying metals put in a bottom. Plus, don't miss Robert Ian's latest report as he wraps up the show. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Sunny skies appeared over the precious metals markets this week following a surprise cut in the ECB's lending rate, increasing inflation expectations. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold finished up about $2 at $12.52 an ounce. The LME is still higher for the year by 1.5%. Silver added 18 cents, finishing at $19 even. Palladium added $10, closing at $846. And platinum ended at $14.50, off less than half a dollar. West Texas Intermediate crude ended near the break-even point, still above the century mark at $102.79 per barrel. Gold rose sharply following the jobs report this week. According to the Labor Department, employers added 217,000 jobs last month, beating economists' forecast. The surge in new U.S. jobs from February to April was the best three-month period in 2 years. Unemployment rate, though, held steady at 6.3%. Another top story driving the markets this week, the European Central Bank is the first major central bank to drop a key lending rate into the negative territory. The ECB unveiled groundbreaking measures to fight deflation, cutting its lending rate to 0.15%, a new low, and then the overnight lending rate down to negative 0.1%. The announcement sparked the biggest one-day gold gain in weeks. The ECB chief promised further measures to encourage borrowing, including the potential of further easing measures amid regional economic sluggishness. The news was viewed as inflationary and thus solidly bullish for the precious metals. Investors will be watching the next FOMC meeting for signs of the next move by the Fed governors. The meeting is slated for June 17th. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, after reaching lower lows this week, the precious metals found support on news of the ECB easing. However, the technical situation hasn't changed too much since last week. Gold needs to clear that 1275 resistance point before any recovery can materialize. So for the rest of this report, all of next week's forecast, as well as all the stock picks and candidates, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the third week running, with the two top benchmark indexes, the Dow and the S&P, finishing at yet the highest points in their history. For the week, the Dow was up 207, ending at 16,924, within earshot of 17,000, not too far from my 18,000-plus target that I gave folks over 2 years ago in the Alpha Stocks newsletter. The S&P 500 added 28 points, wrapping up at 1950, while the Nasdaq added 78, finishing at 4321. The news story du jour pushing the shares to new highs, of course, that Labor Department report, which showed that employers in May added to payrolls well beyond the peak that we saw before the last recession in 2008. The reading marked the first time since 1999 that the economy has added at least 200,000 jobs for four straight months in a row. More jobs means the typical consumer's wallet is filled to capacity with dollars, which will spill over into higher corporate profits and equity share prices. My Alpha Stock subscribers know that I keep an eye on the IPO market for opportunities, and that's following their initial pricing. Now, we had one big pop this week in one of our candidates in the newsletter, but there was also another big pricing this week. Arista Networks rallied 28% in its trading debut, and this is one of the hot signs we look for. It priced well above the price range, $3 above the price range. We also had another one this week, but the share prices did not hold up too well. And of course, this is good news for our Alpha subscribers. We're going to add both the ticker symbols to the 30 IPO watch list that I keep an eye on every evening when looking for new opportunities. And when we see a buying opportunity, you'll be the first to hear about it. Other stocks in the news, Verifone Systems, ticker PAY, added about 8%, following news of better-than-expected quarterly results. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index pendulum we watch like a hawk finally moved from the neutral category into the extreme greed portion of the reading, and that suggests that investors have finally gone all in. They're ebullient over equities. And of course, my longtime listeners will know that that is not a very good sign. We prefer for the sentiment index to do the opposite of what we expect. When we see all of the ducks lined up in a row, that usually means a pullback is imminent. People are just overly excited about stocks right now. Now, one caveat, remember, this is not a timing mechanism. It's just an indication that the best values have likely been found, and better prices are likely to be found in the coming weeks. Up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with James Turk and David Gerwitz, so we'd like for you to stay with us right here with Gold Seek. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com and co-author of The Money Bubble, a new bestseller on Amazon. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, we wanted to talk, if we could, today about a top story here. The European Central Bank cut interest rates to record lows, and this is imposing negative rates on overnight depositors. The ECB dropped its rate, its benchmark there, to negative 0.1%. And some folks are claiming that this is reminiscent of the BOJ's battle with deflation. You know, when the Fed tried something similar, it helped to spark one of the sharpest gold rallies in decades, and the markets rallied on the news. Please tell us more and what you think about this.
Yeah, it's not too surprising we saw good rallies in both gold and silver after the ECB announcement. And basically what that's telling us is that the European Central Bank has taken steps to debase the value of the euro. They think that by debasing the currency, they're going to stimulate economic activity. But you've got to look at this logically, Chris. You know, over the past several years, they've dropped interest rates basically to zero, and economic activity has not been stimulated. The Eurozone is still having economic difficulties, record high unemployment rates, barely registering any kind of growth whatsoever. Some countries are actually contracting. So by lowering interest rates even into negative territory, is it really going to make a difference? It probably won't help economic activity, but as we saw with regards to the big bounces, the big moves in gold and silver after the announcement, it is definitely going to help the precious metals. And the reason is that this was a clear message that the ECB is trying to lower the value of the euro, lower the purchasing power of the euro. And if you're lowering the purchasing power of the euro, you have to look for alternatives. And obviously the precious metals are a good alternative.
return here to the U.S., domestic economic reports seem to be improving, and that looks like it's sending money flows away from safe havens and into the U.S. equities markets, which have just been the investment du jour now for quite some time. U.S. durable goods orders rose in April, as we learned last week. Initial jobless claims improved. I mean, the Fed is also paring back its monthly asset purchases to $45 billion, the fourth straight $10 billion cut, or taper, as they're calling it. Can you tell us what improved conditions on this side of the pond might mean in the context of your first response?
You know, the stock market is not rising because of good economic conditions or nor because of any rosy economic outlook. I mean, the economic outlook looks bleak. It actually, you know, the U.S. is actually finally, the government numbers are showing that the U.S. was in a recession in the first quarter. And it could very well be in a recession, negative GDP growth, or very close to negative GDP growth in this current quarter. So the stock market is rising not because of the economy. It's rising because of what the Federal Reserve is doing. The Federal Reserve is printing more money, and that money has to go somewhere. This is what in Austrian School of Economics is called the crack-up boom. You know, people flee the currency, and they go into things. So you're seeing, for example, Chris, not just in the States, but the dollars are being created flowing throughout the globe. So you have real estate here in London going to record highs. You have real estate in Singapore going to record highs because these are perceived safe havens. You've got records in collectibles, antique cars, paintings, and things of that nature. And, you know, when you go into certain types of stocks, you know, stocks that deal in commodities or stocks that deal in things as opposed to financial stocks, a near tangible in the sense that if you own Exxon, you don't necessarily own an oil well, but you own a company that owns oil wells. And, you know, oil is going to continue to be valuable in the future, regardless of what happens to economic activity. So that's the safe haven logic as to why the stock market's going up. But the reality is it's just going up because the Federal Reserve is printing. And even though they've reduced the amount of, you know, QE that they're doing, they're still doing far too much. And the consequence of that is that, you know, the dollar is being debased, just like the ECB is debasing the euro.
You know, this is such a salient point, and I wonder if you could let our listeners today know some of these actions that you're referring to behind the scenes, because, you know, all we hear about is the tapering. But on the other hand, that balance sheet remains stubbornly high and looks as though it's positioned to breach the $5 trillion mark sometime in the near future.
Personally, I think there's a lot of panic going on behind the scenes because the central banks pretty much around the world are unable to respond to the economic conditions. All of the theories that they're following are completely bogus because they don't really work in this present environment. They're built on faulty logic anyway, so it's not a surprise that they don't work. You know, what government should be doing is encouraging economic activity in the private sector because, after all, the private sector is where the wealth is created. You know, governments don't create wealth. They just take wealth from the private sector and redistribute it. And the problem that we have in the States and the problem that we have in Euroland and many other countries around the world as well is that governments have become so big that, you know, all of the feathers have been plucked from the golden goose, which is the private sector. You know, there's nothing left for the private sector to give. And given the regulatory environment, tax environment, and all of the other problems that businesses confront these days, there's just not enough money to go around to support this huge infrastructure that governments have built. And venture planners are unwilling to recognize that this system is no longer working. They're trying to do all kinds of things to keep this old system working, but it's not working. And ultimately, my view, Chris, is it's laid out in the money bubble and the dollar, the coming collapse of the dollar before that, is that we are in a money bubble. People just have lost sight as to what money really is. What we call money today is not really money. It's just a money substitute circulating in place of money. Money, of course, being gold and silver, physical gold and physical silver.
Your idea of a bloated government is such a cogent point and one that's overlooked by so many in the mainstream. For instance, if we look at the United States, take it as the case study, roughly half of Americans receive some type of federal assistance. Now, keep in mind, a check each month, over 160 million Americans receive from the federal government. it's as though the parasite has gone from a symbiotic relationship to a far more nefarious one, threatening the host on which it requires its own subsistence and survival. Could you tell us more?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You really described it perfectly. And just to put some numbers on it, to put it into perspective, government now, as a percentage of the U.S. economy, is higher today than it was during the height of World War II, when the whole country was on a war footing. Now, think about that. It's more government today than we had during the peak of World War II. It's just not sustainable. And, you know, what the central bankers are trying to do is to try to continue the system, which is no longer sustainable. They're fiddling around with all kinds of things, negative interest rates and quantitative easing, et cetera, in the hope that they're going to stimulate economic activity. But the point is they're missing the important point, is that the system has reached its shelf life. It is no longer sustainable. There's too much debt. There's not enough wealth being created. So it's not surprising that standards of living in the States and elsewhere are generally declining.
Although it's not a perfect analogy, if one might imagine that the shoeshine person who is there to make sure that the CEOs and the executives are presentable each day, earning as much, if not more, than the executives themselves. As you say, it's just simply unsustainable for the government, which essentially provides services that should be there in place to support the business community, which of course is the engine of all growth and the engine of all output, that even supports our military and every other function of the country. So I think you made a great point, but I don't want to harp on it too much. Let's move on to geopolitical tensions. I have family in London, and folks in that part of the world keep a very close eye on their backyard. And of course, Ukraine is a pseudo-European country, at least on the periphery. I wonder if you might tell folks a bit more of what you see happening there between Ukraine and Russia, please.
Yeah, they're not really making any progress in terms of resolving the differences. You know, instead of focusing on making sure everybody has equal rights under the law, it's turned into a Balkan type of situation where people are fighting because of ethnic differences and things of that nature. So it's probably going to get messier before it gets better, which is sort of sad. But, you know, because you bring up the geopolitical issue, there's actually a bigger thing happening that I'm not sure is getting a lot of attention in the States, but it's got a lot of attention over here in Europe, is that just recently Russia and China signed a huge, huge natural gas deal, which is sort of a shifting of geopolitical power of, you know, I think real significance in a couple of different ways. First of all, China is going to be getting energy from Russia. But secondly, and more importantly, this is a multi-year deal, a multi-decade deal, actually. And you just know that that deal is not being priced in U.S. dollars. They've not announced what the pricing is, but it's either rubles or yuan or a combination of the two. It's just another, you know, nail in the coffin for the U.S. dollar that nobody wants to participate in the U.S. dollar system anymore for fear of the consequences, because the dollar is no longer a neutral tool in commerce. It's been made a political weapon.
Petrodollar arrangement is crumbling right before our very eyes. Dollar hegemony eroding at a rapid clip. And I think very apropos to point out that they didn't announce whether or not it was what the currency would be. But maybe the time is not too far off that no currency is available for this arrangement, that folks will only settle in gold. Despite the fact that the yuan and perhaps ruble are relatively stable currencies, they're all fiat currencies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it gets to the heart of the theme in the money bubble. You know, goods and services pay for goods and services. You cannot walk into a shop and pay for something with credit and expect the shopkeeper to have actually received payment. If he receives credit, he doesn't actually get payment until he takes that credit and goes out and buys some good or service. In other words, tangible assets pay for tangible assets. And what we're using today in the world with all of these fiat currencies is just credit of the banking system, credit of governments, credit of central banks. It's not actually extinguishing payments, and you've got this huge buildup of debt. And the debt itself is in part backing the currency system rather than real tangible things. So to me, the system is very fragile. And I'm sure we've discussed this in the past, but I always like to bring it up. It's like in the late 1960s, just before the collapse of the central banking cartel called the London Gold Pool. You know, they kept the gold price at $35 an ounce, by just hoarding tons and tons. In fact, 10,000 tons of gold came out of Fort Knox at $35 an ounce to try to keep the market there before they finally threw in the towel because they knew that you can't, as powerful as governments are, they can't overpower the free market because, you know, free markets rely on things of value. And ultimately, a price goes up or a price goes down because of how the free market responds and what the perception of value is of that particular item. So, you know, we're like the like it is in the late 1960s. You know the system is unsustainable. The trouble, Chris, is you just can't predict when it's going to happen. So what you have to do is basically just, you know, keep preparing for it and getting ready for it. The best way to do that is to own physical gold or physical silver or other types of physical assets, be it farmland, oil wells, mines, timberland, or companies, equities of companies that have ownership of tangible assets. Because in the end, when this collapse comes, it's going to be like 2008, but worse, because there's a lot more credit outstanding today than there was back in 2008.
You know, I think it's well said. And folks who seem to be less astute in the area, they want to paper over the possibility that there's really never been a situation, all global currencies, that this could come like a thief in the night this time around.
The point you're making is a good one, that, you know, all global currencies are fiat, and when people lose faith in fiat currency, it'll happen quickly, and those consequences will be one for the history books.
I'd really like your comments on the London silver market fixing. I'm sure you heard in the past couple of weeks that they'll no longer publish the London silver fixing, and this was a global benchmark used to price silver. It was essentially a conference call between Deutsche Bank, HSBC, and, of course, the Bank of Nova Scotia. According to a Wall Street Journal article, this is quite an interesting sea change event, and some folks are calling it similar to the LIBOR rigging situation, that perhaps we could see the gold fix be the next monopoly to crumble. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good possibility. The fact that Barclays Bank was fined £26 million just recently for manipulating the gold price during the gold fix shows that the fix as it's presently being operated is antiquated. There is a need for a reference point during the course of the day that's public, transparent, and most importantly, a reference point where people can actually deal on in physical metal, and people who sell short physical metal in the fix actually have to have that physical metal on hand rather than just putting in a piece of paper saying they're going to deliver the physical metal at a future date. So there is a need for that reference point, and I'm hopeful that the LBMA, the Bank of England, or whoever will come up with a solution using present-day technology rather than something that goes back to the 1920s.
Very good. Well, James Turk, we want to thank you, and I know the listeners are going to appreciate your comments. So would you like to share any contact information?
I'm available through goldmoney.com. There's a lot of material there that basically provides what my views are on the precious metals. And as always, Chris, it's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have David Gerwitz back on the show today. He is the managing director at Charles Nenner, and this was his second appearance on the show. Hello, David.
Hey, Chris. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Last time we had a long discussion about one of our favorite mathematicians called Euler.
We sure did. And, you know, it's funny that you would mention that because the more one delves into his work, the more fascinated one becomes with it, and the more one realizes just how little we know. It makes you wonder how someone a couple of hundred years ago, without the internet, without computers, and everything was by hand.
Well, let me tell you some of his quotes. And your listeners are big brains. A lot of them wrote to us afterwards, so they'll appreciate it. When he lost his right eye, right, he said, "Now I have less distraction." And then he was quoted "Madam, I have come from a country where people are hanged if they talk." He said this. He excused his quietness in a conversation. So this is a guy that came up with more than probably anyone in the last 1,000 years, other than maybe Tesla. And he was so humble and saw things in a different way. And you mentioned about, you know, hand calculating and things. Charles Nenner, I've had the pleasure of working with him. And your listeners should go to charlesnenner.com and request, you know, a free sample of the work for a month. He came up with this system of predicting based on being in medical school, and then he heard his professor said people get admitted to insane asylums all at the same time. After they had said that we need more doctors during full moons because there's greater births, he said, that makes sense. That cause and effect, full moon, greater births, but insane asylums, they're getting admitted at the same time? So Charles came to New York and wound up going to the library and by hand started finding top-to-tops in IBM. And that's how he came up with the cycle thing, by hand. And now we have obviously pretty fast computers and thousands of clients. And Charles predicted the top and gold, the top and Apple, a lot of tops and bottoms. And a very big business. But like you say, he did something by hand.
Some folks have a proclivity for patterns.
I mean, I don't know if your listeners, I mean, I could say about this because I'm a math major and musician from math. When I'm interviewing you now, Chris, let's take 5 minutes. I'm going to interview you. You're coming out with a book about primes and the fact that there's a different higher prime than what's thought. Is that the summary of what you're doing?
Well, you know, actually, this is just a brief journal article. I mean, I appreciate the kudos there, but no, not a book. I listened to one mathematician once say, in math, we really prefer simplicity. We find an equation that's maybe a few lines long to be beautiful, but then we're expected to write a 200 or 300 page book around it. Hat tip to anyone who can pull that off, because there have been many folks who have, but I think I've made a couple of interesting breakthroughs just by looking at numbers in a different way. During his time, Christian Goldbach sent him a message known as the Goldbach conjecture and the weak Goldbach conjecture. Every prime number over the number 5 is comprised of 3 smaller primes, and it was recently proven, which a lot, even some folks in the math community are not aware of. So at any rate, I just extend that proof in reverse. I just traverse down the number line and make a couple of deductions, and it just works. But at least I think that it's interesting, and apparently a couple of journals do as well, and that's all that history will ever know about it.
Well, let me add another quote to you from Euler regarding this. You're going to love this. Quoted in G. Simmons' Calculus Gems. From Leonard Euler, mathematicians have tried in vain to this day to discover some order in the sequence of prime numbers, and we have reason to believe that it is a mystery into which the human mind will never penetrate. And you are proving opposite.
Well, no, that's very kind of you, but I can tell you there are many other folks who I think have done a better job. But what I think is interesting, there is obviously order. Where I'm finding it is in the twin primes. I think of the twin primes as a marker. And if you take a look at Ulam's spiral, and wow, I'm really getting off topic here, there's obvious order within primes. In fact, I would say primes are the ultimate order.
It's an author named Mario Livio. Senior astrophysicist, head of the Office of Public Outreach at Hubble in Baltimore, and he wrote several books, The Golden Ratio, which I highly recommend.
Golden Ratio.
The equation that couldn't be solved, and he wrote, Is God a Mathematician? Really brilliant at it. Anyway, what he writes about is the number 5, and I hope your listeners haven't shifted off already, but they'll find it fascinating, and again, they should write to charlesnenner.com and say they heard this discussion between two crazy guys, Chris and David. And they want to see what we're talking about with our research. We know that the Fibonacci sequence, every number is the sum of the previous two. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21. As you start to find the differences between the numbers and put one over the other, as you know, 3 over 5 is 0.6. 5 over 8 is 0.625, right? 8 over 13, 13 over 21. All those numbers after are around 0.618. That number is known as phi, the perfect number, right? It's interesting that in the Elliott wave analysis, one of the retracement levels is 0.618. The second one is 1.618. The other is 2.618. Now, if that's a pattern that Mr. Elliott found based on the Fibonacci that appears in markets, which we look at, there are other patterns as well. One of them is called cycles. what cycles, according to us, which is very important to understand. You could find an apple, which we called the top end 2 years ago, and it was 702. We said buy puts. Everybody thought we were crazy. I didn't do this. Charles comes up with this. I just done the mouthpiece, thank God. So we find cycles from equidistant top to tops in any data series. So therefore, if Apple originally was 90, then 100, then 200, then 300, let's say it topped at each $100 value, and the top was in an equidistant value also, I mean, it happened every 5 weeks. And then there was a top every 20 weeks and 50 weeks, and you drew all those sine curves together, like an EKG, a set of EKGs, and you overlaid them. Let's say they're all topping 2 years ago. That's what happened. All those cycles top for Apple, and that's how we were able to predict the top. And if you extrapolate that, that's what we do for everything in order to just get direction. Because it can't give you level, because if there was a top at 100, 200, 300, that mechanism can't give you level. It only gives you direction. It was made up of a lot of different levels. In order to give targets, that's a different algorithm. And we have a separate algorithm for targets. That's why we're very precise. We call the gold bounce from 12 up to 13. We said it's on a down move now. We think long-term it retests, ties, and goes past. And we're near a bottom, but we took everyone out of 1900. And I hope I just explained the basis of how we did it. Forward-looking, we're near a bottom in gold, a little bit further out in gold stocks. And we think we're going to retest the highs. I know you, I don't want to say anything, but I don't see it by next summer to be 2400. But it will go back there, if not more so, over the next few years. Same with silver approaching 50, if not more.
I think the key walkaway here is timing is maybe a little more tricky than targets, and I think we have to be a little more patient. I think I agree with you there. At some point, when momentum kicks in, that's when it becomes more difficult, I think, to gauge just where the top. I think it'd be interesting to apply Fibonacci, the sequence, looking for forecasts, you know, on the upside.
Again, Eliway's one piece of finding levels. We don't use it as our main piece. We have a whole different way to find targets. And we like it to line up with the LA wave, but it's not the main thing that we use. And since, you know, stocks we do it for, we think we're near a top in stocks. Bonds, we call the rally from the beginning. It's hitting a wall now, but it should come back into the summer. The VIX, which has been very low for a long time, that's a harbinger of trouble coming. And so stocks, bonds are going to, over the next 5 years, not be so pleasant. And They have kind of gone in the same direction the last 30. Think about it, from 81 till now, both bonds and stocks are up, but not always, because 87 gold stocks topped, 2000 stocks topped, 2007 they topped, but bonds have always been, that's how we look at it. Therefore, it's easy that they both go down. Now, what happens when they both go down is not going to be pleasant.
Well, it's going to be pleasant in some market. There's always a bull market somewhere.
Well, yeah. We think grains will be a bull market. We think the dollar will be a bear market. And that's why your listeners, and quite a few wrote in last time, should write in again and watch the research free for a month and see what we're saying about stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, economic indicators, all the global macro-traded things.
When I'm thinking, though, that if the safe haven of bonds, some folks think of it as a safe haven, and stocks lose favor, that there are going to be huge money flows to the tune of trillions of dollars.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's another thing called currencies, and that is a huge factor. And that, actually, we send out, the first thing we send in the week, Sunday night, we send a bunch of charts around 6 p.m. Eastern time, because that's when the trading starts in the Far East. And that's, it usually starts in currency trading, you know, and money goes so fast now, from currencies to bonds to stocks to commodities in 20 minutes, you know. So that's what, I didn't know this when we started. We have a lot of clients in the Far East also, and they're like waiting for that, even though we're not always on the Sunday work giving such short-term stuff. We're doing more longer-term stuff. We have a lot of clients in the Far East. Like, we have some of the sovereign wealth funds with $80 billion a few years ago asked us about copper. And I knew they wanted to go long. They don't usually tell us, but they said, we're thinking of buying a lot of copper, and we saw copper down for 2 years. We told them. I don't know if they listened, but we were right. So there's still deflation push, which is rather substantial. And, you know, that's why it's important to watch. It's kind of important that people stay very, very cautious.
Well, listen, let's move on to another interesting topic, gold stocks. And we've talked a little bit about commodities, and we've talked about stocks and bonds in general, the general equities markets. But, you know, a lot of our listeners are concerned about the XAU. It's been a very troubling 4 or 5 years in the sector, and some people are talking about a washout capitulation. We've had Jim Rogers from his Singapore office here give us some ideas about what he sees, that eventually there should be a moment where investors just toss up their hands and say, we just can't take any more pain. Do you see a scenario like that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, but it's coming to an end soon. That's what we see. But being that we called the top, we might be able to call the bottom, but we do see that it's got another 100. I'm not talking XAU now, I'm talking gold. It's got another 100, 150 potential on the downside. But it's not like another 6 months to happen. We think gold stocks are bottoming in a few months, and gold possibly next month, but we'll see how they interplay. But we're near a bottom, and that's why, you know, we're not in, so we don't feel the pressure. A lot of people are, and that's why it's important, we think, to people to recognize the emotional cost of trading. Even if you do it well, you get exhausted. So is it worth it so that when you're sitting there on a Monday, when you have other opportunities, you've been so tired from battling other things, you won't feel comfortable to take like a 10% of your money trade in something that should go because you're tired from doing the other thing. People never think about that, I think. And that's so important to factor that in. That's why the cycles help keep you to the sideline, which is another thing very difficult for those who stare at screens. How do you stand aside?
If I'm hearing you correctly, you know, we still have some more downside. I've been warning all my readers about this for a while. I mean, it clearly broke some important support in the last 2 weeks. You know, within the bigger picture, we have been meandering, sine waving within a large consolidation for about a year now.
Let me read you what we wrote yesterday, so you get an idea in the update, which comes out 3 times a week. Gold, we saw the expected weakness in gold. Sell signal continues. Doesn't mean go short. It just says sell signal, mean not being on a, don't be long. And those who are adept traders can be short, but not everybody has the same skill. However, some short-term cycles bottomed again. Therefore, based on these cycles, we expect to see a short-term bounce till the end of the week, especially when we see a close above 1260. That's June contract. Silver. Since silver cycles seem to bottom earlier than gold and is getting closer to a downside target of around 1830, so far silver saw an intraday low of 1860. Close above 1945 is the first signal we've seen the low. That's how we write. We assume everyone has ADD. They have 14 seconds to read it. That's what we see. And that's why people like it, because it takes 4 minutes to read the whole thing. You know, takes us 3 hours to write it and make it seem like it took 14 minutes. And I edited it. So we wrote this for Goldman, 6 pages every day, 4 charts a day. His boss was head of global macro trading and said, no one's paying any attention. Write it on one page. It's Goldman Sachs, right? So he turned it into this. This is what it became. We think this is the bottom. We call the top after 10 years of, you know, going up. So we might be right with the bottom. Yeah, so we don't think it's a continued trend, but we do think there's deflation in other things. The dollar will be deflating. Stocks will be deflating, not Apple, but stocks, meaning crashing. It's not always that case.
Correlations, they break down all the time.
Right, so that's why cycles tell you how they dealt with it in the past. I'll give you an example. Your listeners should go Google 100-year war cycle. 100 years ago was World War One. What do you find? 100 years ago was World War One. 200 years ago there was a song written called The War of 1812, the Overture of the War of 1812.
Ah, interesting. Yes.
1716 there was a war. 1611, and this goes back for the last 1,000 years. Second decade of every century, there was a war. Good at deprived, Chris. Right. So it basically, that's what Charles said 3 years ago, there's going to be wars. Now, he wasn't looking at that cycle. He was looking at other cycles. And look what's happening. Mr. Putin is not sitting around playing tennis all day. China and Japan are not exactly having the greatest love affair right now. There's a war going on in Africa. Turkey's cutting off the water supply of Syria. I don't know if everybody knows this.
I am quite familiar with his forecast on war. Now, the last time that it wouldn't be apparent until, let's say, 2015, 2016, but to the more astute, they're going to see signs of potential global war as soon as the end of this year or early next year. The last time I checked, he was talking about the potential for nuclear war, and he's very concerned about the Middle East.
It's not a two-minute conversation, probably not for the show, but if we're talking about markets, and what effect it has when we see things heading down, we don't know what causes it. That could be what causes it. And it could be flu. You know, there was a time not that long ago, 50 million people died of a flu. It wasn't that it was in this century. Nobody remembers. Nobody thinks about it. So that's the type of stuff we think about. Barry, you're not going to see it in the press. You're not going to hear about it much because, you know, people don't want to hear it. The same thing here, but it seems to be that patterns repeat. How else could we predict what we do? And, you know, this is very different. We don't see a trend being the same as a cycle because a trend is part of the cycles, but how else can you see around the corner if you just follow a trend or like a 200-day moving average crossing the 50-day, creating what is known as the gold.
But I believe that if you really scale up and you look at, let's say you've got a trend in a much lower time frame, that if you're really going to have to, you know, be Mandelbrot for a minute, and you're going to have to scale up fractally, 2, 3, 4-fold up, but you're going to notice that trend is little more than a cycle, but it is a huge cycle. You might think of it as a Kondratiev wave.
There are multiple cycles. There's cycles based on daily data, based on weekly data, based on monthly, based on quarterly, based on yearly. We try and have them all line up because that's where, if they all line up, you have almost a 95% trade.
Well, I'm thinking more in terms of relativity. I'm thinking in terms of Einstein's relativity, that it's really your perspective, where you're standing, and the speed at which you're viewing the markets that would reflect whether or not we give it the moniker trend. A trend is really a cycle, but it looks like a trend simply because it's stretched out and long. But if you step way back, I mean, you'd almost have to use your refracting telescope to see it. This is just a portion of the curve of a much larger cycle.
No, that's well put. And again, what happens when you have many cycles and then they're all lining up or they're crossing and conflicting, our attitude is stand aside.
This really begs the question. Why do we have so many cycles? Is it cosmologically based? Is it sociologically based?
We don't know the answer, but it seems, it's a very good question, but it seems to be that humans assume they have free choice. You know, you go say, I like vanilla ice cream. Reality is God created your tongue to prefer vanilla. You know, I don't like strawberry. So to say I want vanilla, I'm choosing vanilla. No, I don't. My tongue doesn't like strawberry. So maybe in the bigger picture, what we think is the free choice, given that we tend to repeat, look at this 100-year war cycle that I just mentioned, we tend to repeat things in patterns. So if that's the case, maybe we don't have the free choice we think.
But do you not worry that there might be forces at play here, and I don't want to get too conspiratorial, but, you know, one almost wonders, well, is society being manipulated by those in higher places who recognize this tendency and are playing on it?
To your question, they don't have the power to change those bigger forces. They may not be aware of it and think they're manipulating. You know, there was a flash crash 2 years ago. If you remember, there was a flash crash last night in Russia, by the way, the market did. The next day, Charles sent something out. You know, we're talking about Elliott wave before. 0.618, 1.618. There's also one of the ratios that it moves is 4.2. Do you know that flash crash was not random? It was an exact 4.2 times retracement. But therefore, it may have looked like a flash out of the blue, exogenous event, right? But it fell into a great pattern that has existed forever. That's why we're crazy enough to try and predict things.
You're not as sanguine as we are here. I mean, you're afraid that this ultimately ends badly. We've had Harry S. Dent Jr. on the show. He is firmly in your camp that when this ends, we could be looking at as low as 3,000 on the Dow Jones Industrial.
Well, that we don't know, but it's going to head down a lot over the next 5 years. I think grain stocks could be up. Grain, you know, there could be food inflation very much. You know, that's kind of what we see pretty soon.
But don't you think that the Fed at some point, I mean, they're going to try to step in just like they have every single time before?
I don't think they're going to be able to do anything. Let me answer your question a different way. When cycles are moving a certain way, they think they can do it. But when cycles go the other way, even if they attempt to do something, they won't be able to affect it. And so it's still cycles. It's just that we attribute a lot of power to a man-made group called the Fed, or a person, Janet Yellen or Bernanke. You know, Charles likes to point out Greenspan, when he spoke to Congress a long time ago, said, you know, there are cycles we can't do anything about. So, which, look, we're only human, right? And humans fall into patterns. That's kind of what we're saying. There's no power out there that can manipulate to it may seem like they're doing it, but they're not. And that's why it's important to watch the research over time to see that it tends to be quite accurate. And, you know, that's why people have a hard time saying, how can you disregard the news? I'll give you an example. I'm not going to say the station, but, you know, we're pretty well known in the financial markets all over. There's one station that won't have us on unless we want to come on when they want to say gold is either top or bottom. Now, here people are watching, and they see a guy saying, gold's topping because of this. That show wanted to show gold topping. They weren't reporting a guy saying it. They had an agenda where they wanted to present. So there's a lot of misinformation based on those types of stations. Again, I'm not going to say what it is. But we've turned those down because I always say, look, why don't you ask what we say rather than tell us what we should say? And that's why I think the media, very often, you are not the case because you're alternative. You know, they are often looking to present a case that's not the truth.
Well, you know, we all have our perspectives. I mean, I think that's obvious. I mean, look at big industry outlet. I mean, they're primarily on the air. They have jobs. Their kids are going to college because, well, they're promoting services.
Yeah, they're very pro stocks. They don't want to hear bad stuff.
Exactly. And but you know, we've had so much bad news here, I'm very sad to say, in this sector for the last 2.5 years, that anyone who comes on board and says, it looks like a bottom here, you've just made new friends.
Oh, I know. By the way, but listen, I'm only telling them what we see. I'm not doing it to make them feel better. It's interesting that, you know, we have clients in 50 countries at least. And I speak to a lot of them. We have a whole team of people speaking to people. We don't manage money, so we're very honest.
Don't confuse brains with the bull market.
Totally. Also, if Apple's topping, if you have $50 million in it, doesn't keep it up.
This is my favorite trade of the year. We got an Apple about 70 points ago. Have you seen this incredible new technology? They've got their hands on more of the patents and copyrights on this new wafer technology. And so people are going to be wearing computers to the tune of more than our desktops in the next few decades.
2 years ago, this wouldn't have happened because cycles were topping. See, here we have a fundamental discussion. You just made a fundamental statement, which is true. And I'm saying, timing-wise, this wouldn't happen at a cycle top. It would be happening at a cycle bottom. And so take that and apply it across the board and everything.
David Gerwitz, a fascinating discussion. We certainly appreciate your wealth of knowledge. And I wonder if you could give us some parting comments here where our listeners need to be watching anything we haven't covered. And then, of course, tell us more about the services you provide at Charles Nenner.
Just everyone listening should write to the site, say you and I spoke about these math things, and occasionally markets, and they want to see what we do. And they'll get a free look for a month. And then if they're interested, we'll be in touch, and they could, you know, purchase the research, which covers stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies, economic indicators. What are we saying? That stocks, after a five-year run-up, we called the bottom in 2009. We have not been long the whole time. We were long most of it. I don't know many people that caught the whole thing, but we caught most of it. And there was a period we thought there was a top, and then a month later we switched. You know, but not everybody caught that we switched. So, but we were human. But nonetheless, we called most of this run-up, and we're near a top. And look what happened last year. The earnings were up 6%. Market was up 30%. And everyone thought it would continue, and then all of a sudden it didn't. And we said be long bonds from the beginning of this year, which has been a great call until now. And so you get all this from the update. So stocks are toppy. Bonds have a, even though they're hitting a top now, have a ways to go till the end of the summer, and then that's it. And then gold is near a bottom. Silver is near a bottom. You know, crude, we have a downside and an upside that's been in that range for 3 years since we called the top at 147, went down 100 points. And then it's been in this range in between, and it's important to watch because it's really been in the trading range. We think nat gas will go down quite a bit once it gets to that top, even though it has been in a strong move for a while. And then currencies are going to be quite interesting. We kept everyone from shorting the euro about a year and a half ago when Europe looked like it was going to fall apart. And then the Aussie and the Canadian, when they were 68 cents to the dollar 4 or 5 years ago, we said they would go to par, and they did. So I think it's important that people watch and be patient because a lot of this stuff's been sideways. And that's very hard for people to be patient because they feel obligated to do something. And that's something we are very cautious to say, don't feel you have to jump in. Better to wait for a strong bottom or a strong top and do less trades, more stronger. And so far, our business has shown it. We have a client base all over the world, and we're in the media quite a bit. And we, thank God, have had people hear our view that the cycles generate the news interpretation rather than the other way around.
We recognize the fact that you are observing an important religious holiday beginning this evening. David Gurewitz, we want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure. Look forward to the next time.
This is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Eerie is not the word for it. Frightening is not the word for it. Reckless, denial, repeated history, no options left, failure of short-term memory, and no way out are better terms to describe the essence of what was reported in the Wall Street Journal this past week. HELOCs, better known as home equity lines of credit, jumped 8% in the first quarter of 2014 from 1 year ago, according to the industry newsletter Inside Mortgage Finance. $13 billion in new money was created in the first quarter, which was the most for the start of a year since 2009. Of special note is that the bulk of home equity originations were lines of credit and not loans. These numbers are still way below the highs of $113 billion in the third quarter of 2006, but the grease is coming out, and the credit is starting to loosen. Banks are beginning to dust off old lending products like an inquisitor dusts off various medieval devices in a dungeon, preparing for a new round of financial interrogations on a desperate and, for the moment, unsuspecting public, all in an attempt to gain some limited market share as the debt-filled ship prepares to sink once again. Last year, home equity lines of credit and loans totaled $59 billion. The closest year before the real estate boom began that approached that level was 2000, when $53 billion of loans were written. The marketing of home equity loans is going to continue rising. As job losses continue to mount, as reported again this week, more people will begin tapping home equity as a means of survival. Right now, banks are marketing the return of these products by saying they are only offering them to their best customers and only offering loans up to 80% of the home's value, not the 100% we saw during the height of the housing bubble in 2005 to 2007. But darned if history just doesn't have a nasty way of repeating itself. Now more than ever, people understand the game, and banks are counting on that. Despite the feel-good intentions about their best customers and all the good intentions stuff that makes it into the press. If people have inklings of tough times ahead, they are going to apply for as much credit now while they still qualify for it. The banks are counting on it. The Fed is counting on it. Congress and the President are counting on it. But no one is willing to acknowledge it. The punch bowl has been partially refilled with more on the way. You are going to be romanced, partied, and seduced to partake in the next round of debt enticement. Do you have the willpower, values, vision, and strength to just say no? Because your survival depends upon it. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.